I wish I was a mole in the ground. Said I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I would root that mountain down. Oh, I wish I was a mole in the ground.
This is Laurie Mercier, your host today for the Old Mole Variety Hour, where each Monday morning the collective of agitator moles provide interviews, reviews, and views from an underground perspective, which we hope lead to greater understanding, reflection, and action. Joe Clement is our engineer. The Old Mole burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time, the struggles of ordinary people for democratic and sustainable ways of life. This country is perpetually at war on women and their bodies, on people struggling to survive and find adequate housing, and on people around the world. But today's show focuses on how another world and city might be possible. Bill Resnick interviews John Pfeffer, Director of Foreign Policy in Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, about John Bolton's dangerous aggression towards Iran and obsession with regime change around the world. Dan Jaffe continues the second part of an interview with Michael Mahaffey, urban designer and senior researcher at KTH, Royal Institute of Technology in Stockholm, about alternatives to capital-friendly policies that would better address the very real problems in housing equity and affordability we are facing. And I speak to Portland Mercury News editor Alex Zielinski about Commissioner Joanne Hardesty's suggested amendment to Mayor Ted Wheeler's proposed budget to make parks and people a priority. The commission is scheduled to vote on the mayor's budget on Wednesday. Now, here is Bill Resnick.
Hi, thanks, Laurie, and congratulations to Joe Clement, our ace engineer and often interviewer and great musician. John Pfeffer, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks for having me on the show.
John Pfeffer is a foreign policy specialist affiliated with the Institute for Policy Studies in the heart of darkness, Washington, D.C. It's a progressive think tank, an action tank in Washington. He edits the online journal Foreign Policy in Focus for the Institute. He writes a great deal, many op-ed-style articles that address the great issues facing the world. He's done several on the Iran issue today. His recent books include Aftershock, A Journey into Eastern Europe's Broken Dreams, and a novel, Splinterlands of a Global Dystopia in the year 2050, warning us about some of the terrible developments in today's world. But while he has in Gramsci's well-known saying, a pessimism of the intellect, he also has an optimism of the will and the intellect. Things really could change for the better. John Pfeffer, tell us about Iran, why Trump withdrew this country from the arms deal, and tell us about the current struggle. Why is the U.S. so obsessed with Iran?
Well, those are tough questions. As your listeners probably know, the Trump administration came in with a mission to unravel all of the accomplishments of the previous administration, the Barack Obama administration. But top of the list was the Iran nuclear agreement, the agreement that the United States and Iran signed that would put very strong limits on Iran's nuclear program and basically prevent it from ever having nuclear weapons. But Trump basically said this wasn't good enough. He wanted to address other issues in the U.S.-Iran relationship. He withdrew the United States from that agreement last year. And more recently, unfortunately, things have heated up even more. And one could even say that we are on the precipice of a war with Iran. The United States has strengthened economic sanctions against the country. John Bolton, the national security advisor, made a warning that if Iran were to attack the United States or any of the U.S. allies in the region, then that would be a reason for the United States to attack Iran. And then most recently, there were reported assaults on four ships in the Strait of Hormuz. These were Saudi and United Arab Emirate ships. And the United States has pointed the finger at Iran as being behind these attacks. And Iran has denied it. But nevertheless, this has brought us to the current moment where we are bracing for a potential attack by the United States against Iran.
Yeah, we've sent U.S. B-52 bombers within an hour of all of Iran. We've put some warships, aircraft carriers in the Straits of Hormuz, armed with the latest deadly weapons. We've threatened over the years, actually, that we will operate in any way we feel necessary. It seems to me they're really trying to frighten the Iranians into something, but it's not clear that they're really just setting up things to invade in one way or another.
That's correct. The Trump administration has been of two voices on this issue. There has been the kind of fire and fury rhetoric that Trump has occasionally engaged in, which he says that, you know, if Iran were to challenge the United States, we would destroy it forever. Regime change rhetoric from both Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Bolton himself. On the other hand, occasionally we get some glimmer that Donald Trump himself would like to basically pull a North Korea. In other words, completely change his rhetoric, as he did with North Korea, and instead of lambasting Iran, reaching out a hand for negotiations. And he has said, you know, here's my phone number. I want to get together with you guys. I want to sit down. I want to negotiate a better deal. So even at this time of great crisis, where as the United States has been brandishing its stick in a variety of different ways, Trump himself has basically put out what might be considered an olive branch or maybe an olive twig, if you will.
It seems to me that's sort of maybe a sort of good cop, bad cop, or whatever they're doing. But is there a basis for negotiation? My sense is that our Iran policy is basically driven by both the Israelis and the Saudis, who see Iran as their great enemy, because, in fact, they really are challenging, at least providing some challenge or support to the people who are challenging Israeli expansionism and Saudi Arabian, whatever you call that, kleptocratic and merciless state. And it's also challenging the Saudis by assisting other Shiite states in the area or cooperating states to, in fact, rebel against sort of the Sunni domination. It's like Northern Ireland is my sense, but maybe that's wrong. The Catholic-Protestant split, well, there's a Shiite-Sunni split, but it's also a class split with the Catholics and the Shiites as the second group. So is there really a possibility of a negotiation when at least those two countries and many other sort of factors weigh against it?
Well, you're right. It is very difficult to imagine that it will be easy to bridge this confessional divide in the Middle East. Saudi Arabia is predominantly Sunni, although it does have a Shiite minority. Iran is predominantly Shiite, although it does have a Sunni minority. I do think, however, that it's not just a religious divide. Iran is a strong economy. It has a very strong middle class. It has, obviously, natural resources, oil, natural gas. It could very well be the economic powerhouse in the region if it wasn't under rather strong sanctions. Saudi Arabia, I think, is not only worried about Iran's reach, you know, to its Shiite brethren, for instance, in Yemen, or even in Saudi Arabia itself. Saudi Arabia is worried about Iran's ultimate economic power in the region. And I think that ultimately is what it's trying to prevent. Israel is concerned, of course, about Iran reaching across the confessional divide and supporting not just Hezbollah, which is Shiite, but also Hamas, which is predominantly Sunni. So Israel is concerned about that. Israel's concerned about, well, it says it's concerned about a nuclear weapons program, but let's be clear, even according to U.S. analysts, Iran hasn't had a nuclear weapons program since 2003 and probably not even for much before that either. So the prospect of Iran actually having a nuclear weapons program is relatively thin at this moment, and yet Israel has hyped that threat considerably, in part because it helps Benjamin Netanyahu, the current prime minister, secure his political base. So there are a number of different factors that play into this that have little to do with, say, U.S.-Iranian relations per se, dating back to, say, the hostage crisis of 79 or the nuclear agreement on the positive side that the Obama administration negotiated.
This is KABU Radio, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to John Pfeffer, a foreign policy specialist who has written on Iran and the struggles in the Middle East. We've been talking about why the U.S. is sort of involved and what they're doing and the possibilities of some sort of negotiated settlement. John Pfeffer suggested that, in fact, the U.S. does not have basic disagreements with Iran, but some of our friendly states that we support, Israel and Saudi Arabia, really are, in fact, in some ways threatened by Iran. And, in fact, my sense is, John, when you look at the state of Iran, it may be the only big oil-exporting state. Well, maybe Venezuela is actually another state under sanctions and being attacked by Trump. But Iran does have democratic elections. They may be more democratic than the ones we have in the U.S. if you look at all of the factors and variables and how policy is made, although I wouldn't go too far with that argument, but there's still... They're still quasi-democratic and moving in that direction. It seems to me that Iran actually does deserve some support when you compare them to the actions of their adversaries.
Well, you're right. I mean, you know, Saudi Arabia is far from a democracy, about as far from a democracy as you can get. And you don't have to engage in any sophisticated arguments about whether Iran is democratic or not democratic or how or where it is on the spectrum of democracy. The most important thing is that the folks in power right now are reformists, and they have supported a nuclear agreement with the United States. They've supported a more peaceful engagement with the United States and with Iran's neighbors. The alternative in Iran is clear. There are the theocrats, the conservatives, the hardliners. They, unfortunately, are strengthened by current U.S. policy because the hardliners in Iran say, look, you know, we told you not to trust the United States. We told you it was a mistake to have this a nuclear agreement. And now look. Look at where we are. We signed this nuclear agreement, and our economy is tanking because of these heightened economic sanctions from the Trump administration. So it's extraordinarily important for us here in the United States to understand that supporting these reformers, Hassan Rouhani, the president, Javad Zarif, the foreign minister, is vital for sustaining peace in the region, and ultimately, you know, this extends beyond the Middle East because we're talking about Iran's relationship with Europe, Iran's relationship with North Africa, et cetera. This is extraordinarily important to basically strengthen our relationship with this faction within Iran.
John Pfeffer, let's go back to the United States a little bit and the making of foreign policy and action. My sense is that what comes out of the Trump gang is this weird good cop, bad cop, but no actual negotiating position that could possibly work. But what's sort of limiting now Trump from doing something truly crazy and bizarre is the U.S. military, it seems to me, is very wary of getting into another war. After all, they've spent trillions and lots of lives in a hugely humiliating war in Iraq and Afghanistan. The neocons, in fact, are completely humiliated because Iraq and Iran are now, in many ways, allies. What we did in the Middle East was strengthen Iran to the neocons' consternation. And I think they're doubling down. They just want to attack this country who has made them so, this whole group of foreign policy, quote, experts in Washington. You probably see them operating every day. Anyway, but the U.S. military, I think, does not want to get into. They're willing to move their B-52 bombers and put their warships around, I mean, when he orders it. But when he ordered people to leave Afghanistan, they wanted to, and Syria, they wanted to maintain forces, and they did. So Iran, they basically disobeyed his orders, but he doesn't remember things very well. What about, or that's how he operates. What about in Iran? Is the U.S. military, am I right, that they're really hesitant to go on the attack?
Well, generally speaking, the Pentagon is a risk-averse institution. It doesn't want to take any risks that are unsupported by the likelihood of victory. So when John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, asked the Pentagon to draw up plans for an attack on Iran last year, the military, frankly, was aghast. I mean, it did it because, you know, it was being asked to do so. But up until recently, we had Jim Mattis, who, even though previously he'd actually been let go by the Obama administration because of his eagerness to be more aggressive with Iran, in this particular context, he became a much more conservative voice with respect to Iran. But he's gone now. So I'm afraid that what the Trump administration has done is cleared away some of the conservative obstacles to launching an attack. Mattis gone, Bolton himself really narrowing the conversation on foreign policy to just one or two people so that he has preponderant influence on Trump.
He really is a Rasputin, isn't he, in some ways?
Yes. So I'm rather pessimistic about the military serving as the ultimate break on a war on Iran.
This is Cable Radio, Bill Resnick talking to John Pfeffer about Iran. What could stop a war on Iran? What can we do in this country? And what might the Europeans do about the U.S. with their sanctions and their control of international financing, sanctioning countries and actually forcing the entire world to cooperate with its foreign policy? It seems to me humiliating for European elites, but of course they're getting rich off of that same policy. How can we stop a war on Iran and talk about things sensibly?
So quickly, there are three things. One is, of course, popular mobilization. If it's clear to the administration that Trump will lose votes and lose votes by large numbers in the next election, if he were to go ahead with a war, then he would think twice. The second is, as you point out, the external actors, European Union coming up with another mechanism by which it can maintain trade with Iran, but also the actions of Russia, China, other big powers saying to the United States, no way, we're not going to stand by and allow this to happen. And then finally, Trump himself making the decision to stand up to both his Secretary of State and his National Security Advisor, which again is not unprecedented since that is exactly what he has done on North Korea.
Yeah, Trump is looking at the next election. He looks at the polls and he looks at his popularity, right? I mean, he's sort of a TV celebrity. And when the polls go down, and for him, you have to, flattery is everything. So it is possible, in fact, to mount that kind of opposition to that and in favor of a decent negotiated settlement in the Middle East. John, tell us, give us about 30 seconds of inspiration on that, and then we have to sign off.
Sure. It, of course, is a difficult position to be in, to put one's hope on foreign policy issues on Donald Trump himself, given his record. But we have to remember that this is a man who campaigned against the Iraq war, saying that it was a bad idea. He has largely said that he doesn't think that we should commit U.S. troops to conflicts around the world. He is concerned about the amount of money that's being spent on the U.S. military, even as he increases military spending. But this is something that we can hope for, at least for the next 18 months while he is in office.
Yeah, and a big movement here really could have an impact. Thanks so much for talking to us, John Pfeffer of the Institute for Policy Studies. And you can look up Foreign Policy in Focus and see a lot of his writing. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
You're listening to KBOO Portland and the Old Mole Variety Hour. We just heard from Bill Resnick and John Pfeffer, who told us about ways to mobilize to stop the U.S. from going to war in Iran. Now here is the Mole's Dan Jaffe talking to Michael Mahaffey about ways to rethink the housing crisis.
A growing crisis of housing and rental affordability, gentrification, displacement, and houselessness is everywhere in the news in Portland, many cities around the U.S., and worldwide. Here in Portland, at the Oregon State Legislature, major deregulatory policy changes, including Portland's residential infill plan and state legislation, including Oregon House Bill 2001, which would mandate that cities allow multi-unit housing on any residential lot, are moving forward and generating plenty of controversy and polarization. Joining us is Michael Mahaffey. He is an urban researcher at the KTH University in Stockholm, Sweden. He's the co-host of a blog, livableportland.org, and he is an urban designer and development consultant who's been active in Portland area planning and building since the early 90s. This is the second part of our two-part discussion. If you missed the first part, you can find it on the Old Mole Variety Hours page on the KBOO website. Welcome back, Michael Mahaffey.
Thank you, Dan.
Let's turn to some of the specific proposals that are on the table right now that are generating a lot of heat and a lot of controversy in Portland and at the state level that involve what you call deregulatory upzoning. Maybe first of all, what do you mean by that term, deregulatory upzoning?
Well, it's ironic that, you know, in Portland and in Oregon, we think of ourselves as a progressive state, and yet really the agenda right now is very much on deregulation, as you said, and on easing the restrictions on building more units, which is being done for an understandable reason. The concern is that there's a limited supply, and therefore we need to make it easier to build supply so that it will better meet demand and so that prices will come down. But as I was saying in the previous discussion, unfortunately, we're dealing with a complex system that has a lot of elements that are interacting with each other. And that kind of simplistic approach, what I call build, baby, build, really doesn't work. The evidence, the research evidence, I think, shows pretty clearly it's one of the things that you need to do. But, of course, the question is, what are you deregulating, and are you actually damaging the public realm, the urban commons that we all share and that we all treasure? Are you damaging our historic assets? Are we getting demolitions? Are we getting actually the problem, making the problem worse, not better, in terms of affordability and equity and sustainability? And I think the evidence is very disturbing that these kinds of command and control approaches that in this case are command and control to deregulate, ironically enough, but that's what the agenda is. And I think the danger is that that's going to be counterproductive, that we're actually going to make these problems worse.
Let's get into some of the details. There is a movement nationally among some cities to essentially end single-family residential zoning with the goal of increasing density in urban neighborhoods, and with the added sort of argument that single-family residential zones are a legacy of the U.S. Racist past, that they coincide with an urban form that is connected to redlining and residential segregation. Cities like Minneapolis recently ended single-family zoning across the entire city, are now allowing duplexes and triplexes to be built on any lot. And then in Portland, there is a proposal called the Residential Infill Proposal, RIP, which began, I think, about 5 years ago under Mayor Charlie Hales. At the time, it was a proposal to address the concerns about demolition of existing housing to build very large McMansions, one-for-one replacements that were in many cases towering over nearby houses, but also were not adding additional units. It sort of morphed over the years into something different. Second iteration was a proposal to allow duplexes on any lot in about 60% of the area of Portland. And then it morphed yet again in the last year or so, as it went through the Portland Planning and Sustainability Commission, into a proposal to allow up to fourplexes on any lot anywhere in the city, virtually anywhere in the city, 96% of the city's land. It barely passed out of that Planning and Sustainability Commission. I think it won by one vote, and it's now going to be heading toward the city council. How should we think about a proposal like the residential infill proposal?
As I said before, we're dealing with a complex system, right? So we have to be very careful to acknowledge some of the factors that are true. There are grains of truth and maybe more than grains of truth in what some of the proponents are saying. So, yes, residential zoning has a past that's bound up with the racist history of many cities. That said, it doesn't follow automatically that the way to deal with the problem is to, you know, shove new housing down existing residents' throat. It may or may not solve the problem. And what it is more likely to do, in my opinion, is to create a political blowback that is incredibly divisive and incredibly destructive of our civic discourse in Portland and our ability to solve problems. My background is partly in public involvement and in working with neighbors, and I've always found that the best way to do that is to be respectful of people's concerns. Mm. They may be overreacting, they may be have motivations that I find troubling, but they are citizens just like we are, and I think we have to respect the democratic process and the need to be part of a civic discourse, a civic debate.
Let's talk about sort of this, the kind of cultural politics of this set of issues of this moment. I think it's fair to say that the atmosphere in Portland and in other cities that have addressed these issues, including Seattle and elsewhere around these proposed policy changes, has become very polarized and even hostile in some cases. There have been sort of ad hominem attacks by some politicians, by many sort of pro-density, pro-growth groups against neighborhood and resident activists. So I guess I feel like I need to ask, how much, if any, truth is there to these characterizations? Are some neighborhood residents unrealistically clinging to a dated white picket fence vision of single-family neighborhoods?
I find that characterization troubling because, again, I think we have to work together to solve our problems. And I think most people in Portland are genuinely interested in a more equitable city, a fairer city for everybody. And I think we've got to get back to that place where we're all working together on these issues and actually making progress. And we're not going to make progress if we're, you know, acting like Donald Trump, attacking everyone and you know, creating more and more division. And, you know, we were talking in the previously about the irony of Portland as a city that fancies itself a progressive city and Oregon a progressive state. And yet, in many ways, I think we're taking chapters out of Donald Trump's playbook. And in fact, there are people who are very eager to see the growth promoted in Portland to advance this argument about what I call build, baby, build, that we need to just deregulate and allow lots of housing and so on, who are, in fact, prominent supporters of Donald Trump. My colleague Clyde Holland, who is with Holland Development Group, I know Clyde and consider him a friend, but I absolutely disagree with him about his support for Donald Trump. And yet he's one of the major influences with the 1,000 Friends of Oregon right now. So what does that say about where we are politically?
And 1,000 Friends of Oregon has taken a strong stand in support of both the city residential infill project and the state bills to increase housing density.
That's
yes?
right. That's right. And so 1,000 Friends of Oregon and Portland for Everyone, and there are a number of other groups that are allied. And I think in the main, they are very sincere and well-meaning. But I think we really have to be careful about these sort of Trojan horses, if you will, these very convenient rationalizations for what is, at the end of the day, financial self-interest in the main, or at least financial self-interest deeply coloring and affecting, if not outright corrupting, our judgments on these issues. So going back to 1,000 Friends for a moment, I think they've bought into the argument, which I think is entirely wrong on the evidence, that overbuilding in the core is going to save farmland and save wilderness because it's, you know, you build tall buildings and then you don't need to sprawl out into the suburbs. But, you know, the numbers just don't confirm that. There's very small amounts of additional units that you get in the core relative to the entire region. The way to really build lots of units that are more affordable is to go to the places where they're already low density and do infill projects in a lot of the places where there are great opportunities for that. The Grayfield malls, the dead malls and dying malls, the parking lots, the wasted medians and rights of way and areas that they're a little tricky to unlock for development, but they are great opportunities, I think, for the region to create more sort of complete communities in these other much larger areas of the region rather than going into the core and forcing a density down people's throats and creating this unnecessarily divisive atmosphere that we have.
I want to stick with this issue for just a second. The argument that we hear from a lot of the promoters of these proposals to densify and to dramatically densify in a lot of the urban residential neighborhoods is that keeping the current zoning effectively locks diverse populations out of access to certain neighborhoods. Portland, for example, is only counting on rezoning residential neighborhoods to take up about 20% of all the growth in new residents that it's counting on. Yet the argument that accompanies it is one of racial and economic justice, that it is unjust to exclude or to not allow new populations, new kinds of family configurations, to have access to neighborhoods that are sort of residential neighborhoods that are portrayed as sort of being the metaphor of gated communities.
Enclaves,
is used in enclaves. So I guess I want to ask in this way, is it possible to be genuinely anti-racist, genuinely pro-social justice, pro-economic justice, and also at the same time challenge the direction that planning and zoning policy is taking in places like Portland? And if so, what would that look like?
Well, yes, absolutely. And I would put myself in that category. I mean, I think the idea that, you know, you need to change the zoning in order to promote greater equity rests on a huge assumption, and that is that by changing the zoning, you're going to actually create lower cost housing and housing that more people can afford. Of course, I'm not saying that we shouldn't look at our zoning and look at what my friend Patrick Condon at the University of British Columbia calls gentle densification. There are ways to create gentle densification in existing neighborhoods. There are ways to work with the neighborhoods and the neighborhood associations. Another dimension of this that troubles me greatly is the sort of dismantling of the neighborhood associations, blaming them as NIMBYs, and instead of engaging them and challenging them to be more constructive and more representative of their populations, which I think they can be and should be. The key is really that we have to do it judiciously, and we have to do it as part of a true democratic process, which is unfortunately not what's happening.
Following on that discussion of democratic process, you mentioned the urbanist Jane Jacobs last week in our discussion. What do you think Jane Jacobs' vision, her ideas and her battles, what lessons do you think those have to offer us today as far as guiding us in the decisions that we need to make here in Portland and in Oregon?
Incredibly relevant, I think. You know, Jacobs was somebody who did talk about gentrification, and some people aren't aware of that, and they sort of criticize her for not having dealt with gentrification and race and those issues. But she actually did, and she made some very important points. And I'm really, a lot of my thinking is greatly affected by her observations about the dynamics of cities, the kind of problem a city is, as she put it. And if we don't get our head around that and we don't work on the city in that way, we're going to continue to make terrible mistakes, as we have. We need to have a much more distributed, polycentric approach to the region. And if we do that, and if we use tools, specific tool, regulatory tools, tax tools, other tools to restrict the influence of capital, as we were talking about last time, and the protections for existing homeowners and renters, and tools in a kind of strategic approach, then we can make some headway on our challenges. But I think the approach that we're taking right now is actually compounding our problems, not making them better.
Michael Mahaffey, what about these alternative models that you're sort of alluding to? I'd like to get a little bit more into this. What are some alternative models that would genuinely address the gentrification problem, the lack of affordability and equity, without opening the door to, say, unlimited demolition across swaths of an entire city, are there ways to provide the needed housing that also sort of partly or fully decommodify land and housing instead of going further into the hyper-commodification that we talked about last week?
Well, again, you know, you have to be careful even in talking about this of, you know, silver bullet thinking. I think we need something more like silver buckshot, if you will, and that we need to look at a number of tools. For example, damping down this speculative real estate bubble that we're in, which is going to push us into another 2008 if we're not careful, you know, damping down the effect of capital coming into the city, having taxation tools, restrictions, frankly, on foreign investments, as Vancouver has now done. There are tools to unlock underutilized sites. I was talking earlier about in the suburbs, there are many examples of wasted land all over the place, parking lots that are underused, dead and dying malls, excess medians and other spaces. The density of Portland in the suburbs is incredibly low, and yet here we have the irony that the city is wanting to go into places like Goose Hollow, which is one of the highest densities in all of Oregon, and build there instead of going to the places where that really need the density. It's sort of like you're taking the places that are already working and you're going to break them instead of going to the places that, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, as they say. As for a couple of other tools, I mentioned my friend Patrick Condon, who talked about gentle densification. And yes, I think maybe accessory dwellings and complementary infill development that is supported by the neighbors. And I've seen that happen. We've had that with the Rinko station I mentioned earlier. I think it's fair to have targeted protections for existing renters and owners and aggressive help for the homeless. We're falling down on that responsibility, and we need to do a much better job of that. I think we can take a much more constructive win-win kind of approach. You were referring to Yes in My Backyard, and I have friends who are part of that movement. I think they're wrong in the sense that they're too heavy-handed about it. They're wanting to fight with existing neighbors and force them to accept density. What I'd like to see is something that you might call Quimby, a nice name for Portland, quality in my backyard. People who in the neighborhoods, in the existing neighborhoods, will support infill development if it makes their neighborhood more beautiful, more livable, gives them more assets to, you know, cafes and other things that they might actually enjoy having around them. And I've seen that happen. So I'm not just, you know, imagining something idealistic.
And finally, then, well, to end, let's talk about that note of democracy and citizen participation. The critical geographer David Harvey is famous for talking about this idea of the right to the city, and many others have written about it. You mentioned Jane Jacobs's vision. That was one involving active grassroots participation in the democratic processes. You've touched on this already a little bit, but what can other cities' failures or successes offer Portland in terms of lessons around how to preserve that vibrant grassroots democracy?
The point that you made about the right to the city is a really important one, because it's not just a matter of giving people something that they can then go in and inhabit. It's about empowering people to co-produce the city. You know, this is really, I think, what's under threat with the overcapitalization of our cities and the privatization of public spaces. Sometimes that's not literally privatization, but it's domination of the public spaces by private interests so that people don't feel welcome there. And you mentioned Jane Jacobs, she made this point in a very powerful way, that we're all the co-producers of the city. And she famously said that cities have the capability of providing something for everybody only because and only when they're created by everybody. So I think that's what we've got to aim for in our thinking about our urban policies and our public realm.
Well, in closing, how can listeners who want to learn more about these issues or concerned about these issues get more information or get involved, plug into efforts to have a broader dialogue?
Well, I talked about the neighborhood associations, and I think we're in a Difficult situation right now because the neighborhood association system is rather dysfunctional. But I do believe that if we're going to have true participatory democracy in Portland, we need to empower our neighborhood associations, and we all need to join our neighborhood associations, get involved, engage in these issues, and be part of a grassroots process of city governance.
And of course, your blog.
Well, right, and I will modestly give the URL. It's livableportland.org, and we do talk about some of these and provide some links and so on.
Well, that's it for today. I've been speaking with Michael Mahaffey. He's a researcher at the KTH University in Stockholm, Sweden, the executive director of the Systasis Foundation. And if you missed the first part of our conversation last week, you can find it on the Old Mole Variety Hours page on the KBOO website. Michael Mahaffey, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Dan.
We just heard from Dan Jaffe speaking with Michael Mahaffey about how deregulation and build, baby, build doesn't solve the problem of the lack of affordable housing. And they urge more democratic processes for decisions affecting housing options. Now we want to talk about other ways of making the city more livable, and that concerns the upcoming City Commission vote on Portland's budget. Here to talk to me more about that is Alex Zielinski, news editor of the Portland Mercury. Welcome back to KBOO, Alex.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Well, we know that Commissioner Joanne Hardesty has a suggested amendment to Mayor Ted Wheeler's proposed budget, which would emphasize funding parks and recreation by ending the controversial gang enforcement team and making some other changes in the mayor's proposed budget. What have been your observations about the budget process this time around from your many years of following the city's budget process?
Yeah, well, what's striking about this year is specifically kind of Commissioner Hardesty's decision to put forward this really public-facing alternative, or at least some amendments to the current proposed budget. Usually, from my understanding, usually these conversations kind of happen behind closed doors or during work sessions between commissioners or and the mayor, just kind of discussing which specific pots of money should be maybe dispersed in other ways. But in this case, Commissioner Hardesty kind of, she notified the rest of the commissioners that she'd be putting forward some alternatives, but really put it out in a more public-facing way and shared it online and let everyone know kind of where she stood when it came to how she'd like to see the mayor's budget dollars be kind of reshuffled. And unsurprisingly, a lot of that money that she would like to move is coming from the police bureau, which she's been kind of a long critic for overfunding. And that money, like you said, is suggested to come from what was formerly called the gang enforcement team and since October has been called the gun violence reduction team. And wanting to put the 28 police officers who are currently employed there, or actually I believe it's 32 or so, take them from this really specific team and put them back onto the street, onto normal patrol, largely because there's a criticism around how few police officers are really out there doing quote-unquote, you know, community policing and being able to patrol neighborhoods and being able to respond quickly to things.
And Alex, you have a fairly recent article in the Mercury about the gang enforcement team or the gun violence reduction team. From your research and from listening to critics of that, why has it been so ineffective and what have been the problems with that?
Yeah, well, a lot of this conversation is based on a city audit that came out last March in 2018 that found that the data collection and kind of data, you know, sharing in general within that team wasn't very effective. They weren't, officers who were pulling people over were not really putting in all the right information or being able to follow up on kind of the amount of people that they were actually tracking that were, or even putting behind bars that were even affiliated with the gang. And then there, you know, was this disproportionate number of the people who the gang enforcement team were pulling over that were people of color, specifically African-American men, without really any, you know, pulling people over without really any suspicions that they were involved with the gang aside from the color of their skin. And so for that kind of scathing audit really inspired and kind of motivated a lot of Joanne Hardesty's campaign to become a member of City Council. And so kind of going off of that, she's made that the baseline of this current budget discussion. It's tricky because, for good reasons, the police department hasn't shared a ton of other information about like what has been going on or changing within that team, but it's hard to really understand from the public's perspective if the team has made any changes based on that audit, aside from maybe renaming itself and saying that they're focusing more on gun data than gang members themselves. But there really isn't too much information pointing otherwise. So on one side, we have Commissioner Hardesty, who's saying that it's a program that really hasn't been doing a great job, has been disproportionately impacting people of color. The other side, you have the Portland Police Bureau arguing that, hey, this is really important. We are collecting data, but we can't really tell you exactly how it's been used or why it's important or maybe even how we're improving the way that we're interacting with people of color. Part of that could be for privacy reasons. Another could just be poor marketing on their end. But it's a tricky conversation without knowing too much of what's going on behind it.
So that has been one of the characteristics of Hardesty's new position here on the City Commission, bringing to light some of these conversations that had been more secretive in the past. So mm-hmm. this effort to make the city's budget process more transparent, and also suggesting other places where the police budget might be cut back in terms of defunding body cameras.
Defunding body, other areas where the commissioner is kind of suggesting cutting back, yeah. And like you said, she suggested cutting the funds that have been kind of earmarked for eventually purchasing body cameras and rolling out a pilot program of police wearing body cameras, arguing that essentially we don't have that much money to even fully afford that program. And if we did, the main people who'd benefit from that would be the police officers themselves, who'd be able to review the videos before it even hits the public. And so it's kind of this accountability tool that's been a little mismarketed to actually just benefit the police officers. And she's also mentioned there's a number of police officer job vacancies right now. The city's kind of notoriously had a troublesome time trying to fill all of the empty positions for officers. And so she suggested one time defunding kind of those salaries while they're sitting empty and using that towards funding the Parks Bureau and funding programs that are currently quite underfunded. And then, you know, if someone's hired, pulling that salary money back and allowing police officers to obviously still be employed, but not letting it really sit while there's a number of other bureaus that need that funding.
And there's been a lot of mobilization, too, pushing back mm-hmm. in terms of supporting those community centers and the North Portland pool that was slated to be closed. So right. that kind of pushback and mobilization among neighborhood and community groups have certainly, once again, given the budget debate a bit more character. And
She certainly has a lot of people on her side. She's chosen kind of a good group to get behind her, which is families and community members and different neighborhood groups who are really concerned that the community centers or pools or recreation programs in their community are going to cut this budget session, which right now it's Monday. We're 2 days from the City Council's first vote on this budget, and there's no obvious sign that the parks budget is going to be completely funded or that the slated jobs, 50-something full-time jobs that are expected to be cut from the Parks Bureau, that they're going to be fulfilled at all, despite what Commissioner Hardesty is kind of suggesting. It's unclear kind of if the mayor or the other commissioners are really on board with any of those.
And there are also some alternative analyses of the budget from Mary King and Peter Donahue. We have links to those on the Old Mole Variety Hour website, on the KABU website. And thanks so much, Alex Zielinski, for joining us today. You can follow her stories in the Portland Mercury online or pick it up in print from locations all over town. And we'll have some links to some of her articles about the budget and the gang enforcement team or gun violence reduction team that have been recently profiled in the Mercury. The City Council, as Alex mentioned, will take further testimony and vote on approving the budget on this Wednesday, May 22nd, 2 o'clock at the Portland City Hall. And Commissioner Hardesty and other groups have a Facebook event for folks who want to turn out in support of the budget amendments before the vote on Wednesday. For their contributions this morning on the Old Mole, we want to thank Bill Resnick, John Pfeffer, Dan Jaffe, Michael Mahaffey, and to Joe Clement, our engineer. We heard music from Neil Young and Con Brio. As always, you can subscribe to or listen to the Old Mole podcast by going to our page on the KABU website, and you can also find there links to past shows and segments, with further links to even more useful information, including how to follow and contact us. The Old Mole Variety Hour will be back next Monday at 9 a.m.